Want to hear something amazing? Discover matches all the cash back you earn on your credit card at the end of your first year, automatically, dollar for dollar, with no limit on how much you can earn. Extra cash? Come on, how amazing is that? In fact, it's even more amazing when you realize all the places where Discover is accepted. 99% of places in the U.S. that take credit cards. So when it comes to Discover, get used to hearing yes more often. Learn more at discover.com/yes. 2020 Nielsen Report limitations apply.
The Medicare annual election period deadline is coming soon. I'm Meredith Vieira, here with examples of people who found the key to the right coverage at myhealthpolicy.com. Meet Larry. He likes doing things online.
I took my time and found the best Medicare Advantage plan for me at myhealthpolicy.com.
Next is Mary. When she wanted answers, she picked up the phone.
I wanted a local perspective on plan, so I called myhealthpolicy.com.
And finally, Michael.
I prefer face-to-face, so I chose myhealthpolicy.com and enrolled on the spot.
Go to myhealthpolicy.com to learn about top-rated Medicare Advantage plans in your area, including $0 premium plans, or call 1-800-GO-START. That's 1-800-GO-START. myhealthpolicy.com. Meredith Vieira is a paid endorser. KF Agency operates myhealthpolicy.com, not connected with or endorsed by the U.S. government or the federal Medicare program. A licensed insurance agent may call.
This is Jack Wilson from the History of Literature. You're listening to a recorded history podcast.
You know what I want? I want to talk to you.
Hello and welcome to the Raptors Weekly Podcast. I'm Earl Sampson Folk, and today, in the doldrums of the NBA offseason, I thought it'd be a great idea to just answer questions from listeners, from readers. So today is a mailbag episode. You guys ask questions, and my colleague Colin Connors has come on to answer them with me. Colin, how are you doing today, man?
Not bad. Beautiful day here in Toronto. Looking forward to answering some questions. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. It is equally as beautiful in Puerto Vallarta. There was a Category 1 hurricane that rolled through here a couple days ago, but now the sun is shining and all is well.
Was that part of Dorian or anything, or was that its own thing?
No, it was like it's on the other coast. It's like hurricanes aren't usually crazy here because apparently there's a mountain range right by the ocean. That's Puerto Vallarta. So apparently it's tough for hurricanes to like roll through here. So they're usually not so bad. And it wasn't. It just feels like a heavy storm you'd get in Toronto, honestly. Just like a lot of rain. But for longer, I think. Like it's unbroken for like a day and a half. Yeah. But anyway, the mailbag. And I'm gonna read off the ones we got from Twitter first. We'll be responding to the Twitter questions. And also, there was a post put up on Raptors Republic that we'll be responding to as well. And so we'll get into it. David F. at DFRRNT says, for rewatchers of the glorious 2019 playoff run, power rank the best games to watch. Which of the 24 games would you rewatch if it could only be 1, 3, 5, or 10? This could fill minutes or hours. It's not current or forward-looking, but no Raptor fan will tire of this subject. Do you have a power ranking, even like a top three off the dome?
I went with 5, but in no particular order. I've got Game 6 versus the Bucks, Game 4 versus the Sixers, Game 4 versus the Warriors, Game 7 versus the Sixers, and Game 5 versus the Warriors. What about yourself?
That's interesting. Because you would think a lot of people, the closeout game for the championship, that would be the one. But it did lose some of its gusto at the end, so I understand why like it was dropped. I think, honestly, I would do it the same as you. But I think it's, I don't know, what stands out for you in those games that makes you rate it that high? So like Game 6 against the Bucks, why does that one sit at number one?
Well, that might have been the best stretch of basketball that the Raptors played all season in that run between the third and fourth quarters where they won. It was 26-3. Kawhi scored and assisted on about 10 straight, and then they took him out at the beginning of the fourth, which was their absolute Achilles heel for most of the playoffs. They usually got like absolutely killed during those minutes, but then Fred and Kyle were extremely steady. Fred hit a step back three, Kyle took a charge. You know, the crowd was going absolutely absurd. Then Kawhi comes back in and dunks all over Giannis to kind of snatch the best player in the world title from him and really cement that the Raptors are probably going to win this series. So that one was, then the crowd was just absolutely incredible. Like I rewatched some of it last night and you could barely even hear the announcer. It was just great.
Every time that dunk is brought up, it makes me think of the sneaky Kyle Lowry hold on Giannis and just how that is absolutely Kyle Lowry's whole ethos is to play basketball that way. Like it's this hustle up the floor. It's this shovel back pass to Kawhi who's running. And then I'm pretty sure Kawhi could have got it down regardless, but Kyle Lowry can't help himself, but he just has to grab and hold Giannis. Could you imagine if a foul had been called on that in that moment? Insanity.
Yeah. Yeah, that is like a perfect encapsulation of Kyle as a player, that play right there.
It's well, that's one of the most fun things about Kyle and his legacy, I think, is that he has a spot in plays like that all the time. Like big DeMar DeRozan dunks from playoffs in years past. You watch the tape back, you see Kyle sitting in the lane, and he's the guy who set the screen. And it's just things like that that throw the defense into disarray. And he has this little spot in all these highlights that are always, it's never like the typical point guard spot. He's in the mix more often. So he'll be under the rim, he'll be grabbing the ball, it'll be something like that. And yeah, it's cool that we got like a quintessential Kyle Lowry moment, even in something that's like, you know, obviously a Kawhi Leonard moment. That's one of my favorite parts about that. Other things from Game 6, I mean, obviously, like, Freddie. I have a question. It's not like a mailbag question, but what did you think about Fred VanVleet against the Warriors and against the Bucks a little bit, but a bit different in the two? Against the Bucks, was hitting a lot more spot-up three-pointers. And against the Warriors, he hit a lot of isolation shots. What do you think is closer to who he'll be sans Kyle Lowry, if that is the case? Do you think he's more of an isolation scorer? Or do you think, like, the heir apparent to Kyle Lowry, not that Kyle Lowry's an isolation scorer, but he'll be able to lift up a decent load of the offense? Or do you think that he's still a spot-up shooter in the offense when, you know, the team doesn't have Kyle Lowry, or Kyle Lowry shifts to, like, a smaller role? What do you think it is for Fred VanVleet in the future?
I just think his best strength is always going to be his ability off ball. He's such a good shooter. He's really good with moving without the ball. With the bench mob a few years ago, when they really like hit their stride, like they had their best success when DeLon was pushing the ball and Fred was kind of spacing the floor and whatnot. I just think at his size, like, and he's never going to be like an oversized athlete in any way. Like being an isolation scorer is never going to be his forte. Like he can really pick his spots and be opportunistic, but I don't think he's ever going to be a every time down, break you down type of guy. I think like his value is always going to come from just how savvy of a player he is in spot up situations and things of that nature. And I think that's the beauty of having him and Pascal to build around, is the fact that he can play off Pascal so well. And I think he's very good with the ball in his hands. Like he's an exceptional pick and roll player. I just don't think isolation is really his forte.
Oh, that's interesting. This has been one of my favorite conversations to have with, you know, basketball writers, fans, anyone really, is the Fred VanVleet of it all. Is you spoke about him and Pascal Siakam being people to build around. I think Pascal Siakam is a no-brainer, but is Fred VanVleet, you know, entrenched in, like, is he for sure a building block, or is he a very good piece, an ancillary piece on, like, a title team, or is he somebody who, you know, he's a lead guard on a playoff team? Like, I'm very interested what you think of that.
I don't think he'll ever end up becoming an all-star or anything of that nature, but I think he can be a very, very good lead guard on a playoff team. Like, I think he could top out as maybe, like, George Hill on Indiana. Just, like, very solid, defends the hell out of everybody. Like, advanced stats are going to, like, have him, like, you know, well above his value. And just can, like, really, almost like a glue guy in the sense that he gets the guys' balls in their spots. And he can really make, like, he can really make shots off the ball and can run a very functional pick and roll when need be.
I'm always so interested to see what people think of Fred VanVleet. And it's not the question of whether he's good or not, because he is. If you don't think he's good, if you're one of those people who's like, oh, Fred VanVleet, who's that guy? It's probably not worth it to have the conversation. But if you have the underlying notion that, yes, he's good, he's very good, but like, what type of lead guard or bench guard or 3-and-D guard is he going to project into, and who's he going to be until he's like 30, 31 years old? I think that's an interesting conversation. Game four against the Warriors, do you have any big takeaways from that game? Because that was really huge. That's the Kawhi Leonard, like, expletive, we're going to take two game. Do you have any highlights from it off the dome?
Those two threes Kawhi took to open the second half. The first one, he got like a really lucky bounce. It was more of like a set shot. And the second one, he just kind of comes down and pulls from a few feet behind the line with Draymond in his face. I know Fred called them FU shots after the game. I think those were kind of like moments that they kind of, the Raptors asserted themselves that like, we think we're the better team here. And Kawhi is kind of like, we're not afraid of the Warriors. We're not afraid of what they've done. And that was also the game that Fred really took it to Curry. Like, I know Curry ended up finishing 9-for-22, but most of those came when the game was completely out of reach. I know there was a stretch where he was like 5-for-18 or 5-for-19. And Fred was just working the hell out of him, like making him work for literally everything. Like, the Warriors couldn't score all game. The Raptors played incredibly well together. Serge had 20 off of, like, I think he was assisted on just about all of them. It was, that was the game that really made me believe, okay, the Raptors are the best team in the league right now. And I think a lot of other people agree.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, like, how did that affect your viewing of the series? Because, you know, there's obviously you and I we wrote about the series and we talked about the series ad nauseum for, you know, the site. But also as a fan and also knowing the history of the Warriors, you're kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop a little bit in that series. Did you have that feeling as well that you're like, when is the honeymoon over for the Raptors? When do the Warriors, like, take it back? Or does this series become extremely difficult? Like, not that the Raptors get to play really good defense and lock Curry down for a 9-for-22 game, but that Curry shoots like 11-of-16, Clay's like 10-of-14, and the Raptors have to make shots, and it's like run and gun type of game. But the series never became that. What did you think about, like, waiting for the Warriors to reach their full potential in that series and the Raptors kind of stagnating it?
I think that was the game that really showed us that against this Raptors defense, which is, you know, one of the best playoff defenses of all time, the Warriors can't really reach their full strength against it. Like, as much as like that game, Clay came back and Clay was absolutely incredible, but the 73 win core was there and they really couldn't really do anything about the fact that the Raptors had such a smothering defense. They were so keyed in on the two shooters. They were like, all right, anybody else can beat us. And they had such a clear game plan and nobody else could really beat them. Sorry, all fans of McKinney. I really loved you with the Raptors. But and then the Raptors offense was just ungodly smooth. Like, there was a clear disconnect from one side to the other on how the two teams were playing. Like, the Warriors were trying so hard to funnel their offense through Clay and Steph when the Raptors are doing everything to take those two away. Whereas the Raptors were playing like absolute team ball. Kawhi was great in that game, but like, it was pretty, you know, they kind of shared the wealth a bit. Fred had 8, Serge had 20, Pascal had 19, Kyle had 10, Mark had 9, which was a lot for Mark in the playoffs at times. So it was really great to watch.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the functionality of the Raptors offense, because it was really, really bad against the 76ers, and it was basically the Kawhi Leonard show. I mean, like, the historically low numbers, the LeBron in 2015 finals type numbers of the on-off stats with Kawhi Leonard. And then in the finals, you know, the offense off turnover more to Kyle Lowry and Fred VanVleet. Kawhi Leonard wasn't able to just eat the sun and take every possession like he wanted to, like he did for the first few games of the Philadelphia series. You spoke about one of the best defensive teams in the playoffs ever. And what did you think, for me watching that, was obviously the intelligence of the defense, but also that they didn't have a weak spot on the floor. And there was never a switch they had to concede. They were never giving up any spot on the floor. Like, the Curry pick and roll thing, or the Curry switch thing that Houston always goes after, or that Cleveland always goes after, that wasn't available to the Warriors. What else did you think was really important for the Raptors to defend the Warriors as well as they did?
Yeah, I think you kind of hit it on the head. Like, there, not only was it like every single player in the rotation was a good defender, every single player in the rotation was like pretty close to an all NBA defender outside of maybe Norman Powell. Like, Serge, Fred, Mark, Danny, Pascal, Kawhi, and Kyle have all like at least sniffed an all NBA defense nod before, and just like have kind of the collective intelligence where they could switch everything but switch selectively. Like, they made like the most intelligent read you could possibly imagine. And, they like were so good at tiring out the Warriors. Like they made Steph work for everything, and like you could tell that it was starting to wear on them. Like, okay, like can somebody else do something here? Like they did a really good job of just like making things as tough as possible.
And on the other side, I kind of want to ask you, I haven't talked to you about this, but Serge Ibaka's offense during the finals, do you have any words on that? Because I thought it was a really impressive display for him to come and be like the offensive punch for the Raptors off the bench. And that was who he was, and that's what he did. What was your takeaway for his role against the Warriors in the finals? Offensively, that is.
It was just incredible. It was like what you kind of expected when you were talking yourself into the trade a few years ago. Like, yeah, it kind of gave you flashbacks to back when he was with the Thunder against the Spurs a few years ago when he had that like 10 for 10 game. He was very selective with his shots. He wasn't taking any like kind of strange turnaround fades. His touch around the like, you know, floater range or was like I don't think he missed a single floater the whole finals. And he was cutting very well. Like I know Kyle found him really well a bunch of times. Like he wasn't like just kind of parking himself out by the 3-point line. He was very active. He was finding gaps and stuff like that. It was everything you could ask for from Serge. It was he really endeared himself to me. We'll put it that way.
Yeah, it was really cool to watch, and he was so mindful of his shot selection, and he performed at such a high clip that everything just kind of coalesced into this wonderful thing, and you know he became a champion, which was great. The next question from Prabhyot or Prabhyot is, what are you guys most looking forward to this season? Could be a game or growth of a certain player or where Masai takes this team. Personally, I can't wait for the home opener. Seeing the ring ceremony and banner will be priceless. What are you looking forward to, man?
I'm really curious to see what happens with Pascal this year. Like, there's so many different ways this could go. Like, last year, with bringing Nurse in, they really changed the way they were going to use him on offense. They, like, quintupled the amount of post-ups he used. He didn't really use near as many spot-ups. Like, and now this year, he's going to have his role is going to grow even more. Is he going to be running pick and roll? Is he going to get as many spot-ups because people are going to be keyed in on him? Are they going to have him? Because he's, like, especially with Kawhi and Danny gone now, like, he's probably the best defender on this roster. Are they going to have him taking hard defensive assignments, or are they going to, like, rest him? Are they going to play him at the five much and experiment with that since it's a bit of a transition year? Because they could kind of maybe unlock their own Warriors lineup, possibly, with if they learn how to use Pascal at the five. Like, there's so many different ways it could go, and I think he's going to, you know, blow the doors off the league this year, to be honest.
I kind of foresee, on defense, I think they're going to use him as a rover, kind of. You know how Paul George was being used against being used with Oklahoma City? I think we're going to see him settle into a role like that. Like, he's very smart defensively and not in a very calculated way, but there's a lot, like, you can see it's just he has a nuance and a knack for how to kind of engage with different offensive schemes and how to stop different things. And I think if you let him hang around the basket sometimes, if you let him hang around like the arc, let him play how he wants to play, I think that's how they're going to use him. I'm not super sure, but it will be interesting, like you said, to see if he's, because he is, to me, an all NBA level defender. So it'll be interesting to see if they put him up against, you know, number one options on the defending team. I mean, last year we saw him guard Russell Westbrook during the regular season, and in the playoffs 2 years ago, he was guarding John Wall as well. He's guarded like a litany of different players, and there's a lot of potential for even just his defense. And like you said, on offense, there's a lot of different ways to use him. The pick and roll, probably the biggest thing going forward, because if he's fast, if he's bouncy and adequate running the pick and roll, there's a lot of angles that he can create for the roller, for the dive man, and for himself going to the rim, that if he, you know, if he finds the pacing to run it correctly, that could be a really interesting wrinkle. For me, the most interesting thing, I think, well, there's two things, right? Is there's the future of the team, and that's Pascal Siakam and OG Anunoby. And the podcast I did last week with Michael Pina, who's a great writer for SB Nation, the thing we were most interested about was the Pascal Siakam of it all, and rightly so. But as far as like a fan of this team and not looking too far ahead, I think Marcus Saul's offense, how he is integrated into the offense going into this year as opposed to last year, will be one of the most interesting, I guess, wrinkles for me this year. I think it's going to be really interesting to see how they use him at the elbow. It's going to be really interesting to see how they use him for the five-out offense. And especially coming off of the FIBA World Cup, he was fantastic. He played awesome with Ricky Rubio. He was able to stretch the floor, and he was, you know, efficient inside. He has his guile, his strength, and his wit finishing there. And his defense will always be, you know, crafty and great. So I'm interested to see what his role is sans Kawhi Leonard. I think that's the most interesting thing for me. What do you think about Marc Gasol next year?
Hello, I'm Jack Wilson. I'm here to tell you about my podcast, The History of Literature.
Hello. This is Edgar Allan Poe.
Hello. Oh, hello. I'm Elizabeth Bennet.
Hello, come on in.
I'm Emily Dickinson.
Come on in.
Hello, this is Bartleby.
Hello, it's me, Lady Macbeth.
The Scrivener.
Whoa. On the History of Literature, we journey through the world of great books, taking a look at everything from the Epic of Gilgamesh to contemporary classics. We talk to authors and professors, and once in a while, we have a special guest.
Hello, I'm Oliver Twist.
The History of Literature podcast with Jack Wilson, where literature comes to life. Join us.
We'll consider ourselves grateful.
Thank you, Oliver.
More gruel, please, sir.
You bet.
Yeah, I that's actually a really good point, because especially where when he came in, he really took a passive role on offense. Like, there were games, you know, where he would take four or five shots. He took the least amount of shots per 36 than he has basically since he was, you know, 25 years old. And but that's kind of also the beauty of Mark. Like, I remember in one of the games in the World Cup, he didn't take his first shot until I think there was about 4 minutes left in the game when they, I think it might've been when they upset Serbia or something like that. And yeah, I'm really curious to see, because especially where they have a training camp to figure out how they're going to incorporate him. And he is arguably, you know, one of the most established offensive players in this roster. Although that's not really, you know, his MO to try and be a scorer. If this team wants to, like, you know, try and be the best version of itself, they're going to need him to be. So as someone that hasn't watched, you know, Mark on a nightly basis prior, besides, like, you know, a few months last year where he was really not really playing like the Mark that we've saw through most of his career, I'm very excited to see how they use him. Like, I'm curious to see how, what kind of pick and roll chemistry him and Kyle and him and Fred can develop. Cause I think he's, you know, a very intelligent short roll passer. And I think that can, that's going to be very fun to watch.
Yeah, and like not only in the pick and roll, but like his elbow offense, I think will be really interesting too, because not only is he going to be incredibly important for spacing, but the Raptors have a few players that are going to cramp the spacing as well, and that do rely on finding gaps in the defense and cutting, like Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, Stanley Johnson, OG Anunoby, all pretty prolific cutters in their own way. Especially, they have to be creative in that way because they don't shoot the ball extremely well. Obviously, OG shoots it better than the rest of them, or at least has so far in his career. And I think the same way that there was that stretch last year where Patrick McCaw, Norman Powell, OG were all getting a lot of dump offs from Marc Gasol, and it was really kind of expanding their offensive roles, at least when they shared the floor with them. I think that could be a big part of the offense this year, because they are going to have to be creative in the ways that they get looks for, like Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, Stanley Johnson, OG Anunoby. And I think that takes me into the next Twitter question, which I think is a really good question from Will Konkin. Are you guys more high on Rondae Hollis-Jefferson or Stanley Johnson? And what song or songs are they going to play during the ring ceremony? I'll throw that one over to you.
I think for the songs, I feel like they'll probably just play Big Rings. Or I feel like if they play anything besides the Drake song, they're going to get in a lot of trouble. So I think it'll stick to that formula. But as for Stan Lee and Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, I'm definitely higher on Rondae Hollis-Jefferson as of right now, because he's shown so much more. And especially coming off of a really good playoff series against Philly, you know, he's basically like an improved version of Pat McCaw at the four. He's just like a complete Swiss Army knife. You know, he can his rebound, assist, block, and steal rates are all incredible, but he can't really do much to score offensively. But I think he can do a really good job fitting around like a very intelligent team. Like, if he's playing alongside lineups with Mark and Kyle and Pascal, he'll find a way to create an effect. But obviously the higher upside is 100% Stanley Johnson. He might be the most tantalizing player in the league. He's built like a running back at 6'8", but like a 6'8" running back. He's got all NBA, all defense upside, but he just really hasn't found a way to find his stroke. And his turnover issues are really bad. Like, I know he's had a negative assist to turnover ratio for just about his entire career. But the Raptors are very good at getting the most out of guys like that. Like, we've seen from OG, they found a way to get the most out of him, at least in his rookie year. So if they can find a way to use him in a similar manner, like, you know, as a baseline cutter, corner three-point shooter, at least in the first year, maybe if he does decide to stay, to pick up his player option and stay the second year, I think they can really get a lot out of him.
Well, I think it's really interesting too, right, is that I think Rondae Hollis-Jefferson's floor is a lot higher than Stanley Johnson's. But adversely, the ceiling for Stanley Johnson represents a much higher, you know, ceiling than Rondae Hollis-Jefferson's. And I was talking to Michael Pina about this last week, and it really shocked me because I had also had this conversation with Matt Shantz where we were kind of, we were very happy that Rondae Hollis-Jefferson was signed by the Raptors, and we thought it was a really smart signing because his lack of shooting makes him underrated league-wide, but he does a lot of other things really well. But Michael Pina, who lives in Brooklyn and watched a lot of him, he was under the impression that he thought he wouldn't get another NBA contract. And Michael's a really smart guy, so he kind of threw a wrench in how I was viewing him. But I think that Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, especially on a team with Kyle Lowry and Marc Gasol, really, really smart players like that, I think he'll have a better year than Stanley Johnson. I do think, I'm not a big Stanley Johnson believer, but all the things that you said about him being, you know, built like a running back, having tantalizing athletic potential, being, you know, a bull on defense, all that is true. And just because I don't believe in him doesn't mean that he's not going to be incredible or could, you know, transcend the things that have been bothering his game and slowing him down. He could be, man, he could be a really special player. He could be exactly what we thought OG was going to be before his tumultuous last year. Like, he could be headed for this Kawhi Leonard light type of career just based on his physical profile. He just has to fill out the rest and be the rest, right? And I think that's what makes it interesting, is to talk about Stanley Johnson, is to talk about a guy who just has so many gifts and he just has to figure out how to make it all work and mold together to become some type of player. But he hasn't been able to do that. And I'm glad the Raptors took a chance on him. But for this year, I'm a Rondae Hollis-Jefferson guy. I think he'll have a good year passing with, you know, Siakam, Lowry, Gasol, filling the gaps, finding lanes out in transition, or just making good basket cuts. And yeah, I think he'll have a good year, an efficient year, not a James Johnson efficiency year, but, you know, a good year. The next question from Michael G. Coffey. Are there any realistic trades, the big contract three, Gasol, Ibaka, and Lowry, for us slash Raps this year that could bring us to the finals? Having them all walk with nothing in return next summer seems like a long road to being contenders again.
Well, I don't think there's any I think the finals is a bit of a stretch. Like, I think once, like, Raptors fans realize this isn't a contention year, like, kind of plain and simple, the easier this year will be. Like, this is a transition year kind of in every way, shape, or form. And I think that's kind of how they need to see, like, know that that's how Masai is going to approach it. I know there's probably, like, a selling point where, say, if they're the 6th seed at the trade deadline, he'll probably sell off. But if they're the 3 seed or something like that, he'll probably keep a few more. But I think it's more likely they go the other way and move them for younger pieces rather than, like, win-now pieces and try to get more on Pascal's timeline and OG and stuff like that. Get, you know, whether it's young picks or young players, I mean, first-round picks or young players or something like that, I think that's a lot more likely. But I don't really see any type of way. I don't see any situation where they move Kyle, to be honest, but I think it's more than likely they move both Mark and Serge.
Yeah, that's a good point. And it's something that I think is really interesting because we spent, you know, a decent amount of time talking about how Marc Gasol will help unlock guys like Hollis Jefferson, Ananobi, Stanley Johnson, and how important he's going to be to the offense, at least predictably, you would think, but also that he might just be taken away from the team. And on the one hand, maybe that does stagnate some growth that you want on the roster. But depending on the package that's being sent back, you're probably willing to do that because it's either going to fast forward the rebuild or it's going to bring you another interesting player. One that, you know, it gives you 4 times the chance. You get Stanley Johnson, Player X, Hollis Jefferson, and Ananobi to build around, you know, along with Fred VanVleet and Pascal Siakam, of course. And then you kind of say, it's going to be tough out there, space is going to be cramped, but figure it out, especially if Ibaka goes as well, because then who's your big man? Is it Chris Boucher? Is it, like, what's happening with that? So the Raptors next year could devolve into a very interesting and weird team, especially if both Ibaka and Gasol go. But like Mike notes, is that it would be tough if they all walked for nothing and none of them returned. Especially Kyle Lowry, you know, is if he left, and just never came back. That would be a tough pill to swallow. You know, I think a lot of people would like to see him sign on afterwards for maybe a reduced, not a $30 million per year contract, but something like that. And to lose Marc Gasol and Serge Ibaka without getting any assets in return would also be a tough pill to swallow. But that's, you know, that's Masai's whole thing, is you have to weigh what you're going to get in return, what you're giving out, and like how to build with the future in mind. Obviously, we've seen he did it right once in a way that has very rarely ever been done before. The 1 year rental for a championship where the MVP leaves, the finals MVP leaves. So I'm not sure what's going to happen. Like, yet, Mike, like you note, it's a long road back, probably, especially without a wing player or a guard to build around, because Pascal Siakam, he's a big man. It's tough to build around big men for, you know, young teams, for rebuilding teams. That's a tough ask, but, you know, that's the way forward, and I'm sure Masai will figure it out. There's one more Twitter question that we're going to get into. Canoe Girl says, seems like Kyle Lowry might be coaching material after he retires. Are there any precedents for players who have a formal coaching role in their last couple of years as a player? I can't think of any. Do you know any?
Well, there's, you know, if you go back to the 60s, there's player coaches like Bill Russell and whatnot. But the example that came to mind for me was...
Not in the NBA, though.
Yeah, in the British League. the one that came to mind for me was Earl Watson. A few years ago when he took his last contract with Portland, part of the contract was... They wanted him to come in and mentor Lillard because he was only in like his first or second year. But they also said that he could be part of their coaching routine. So he was in coaching meetings and whatnot every day because he was pretty certain that he wanted to become a coach after his career. But to be fair, Kyle Lowry is a far, far better player than Earl Watson. And Earl Watson was on his last legs when that kind of came around. So I think Kyle's, you know, like 3 or 4, if not 5 years away from really saying like, okay, I want to spend half my time working on my coaching and stuff like that. But also from the perspective of, I don't really know if Kyle would want to become a coach in the sense that like he doesn't really have the clout to get a head coaching job right off the bat, like a Jason Kidd or a Derek Fisher. And the life of an NBA assistant coach is not glamorous at all. So unless it's something that he's very, very like adamant that this is what I want to do, I don't see him just kind of like dipping his toes into it. But then again, like Kyle's a very unpredictable person and he is an absolute basketball savant. So if he wants to get into it, I'm not saying he wouldn't be successful at it, because I think he definitely would. It's just not a very glamorous life to kind of like, you kind of go back to the bottom and he just, you know, spent all this time working himself up to become this great NBA player. I don't know if it was something that would totally interest him.
Yeah. And not to play into the armchair psychology too much. And I don't want to be offensive to Kyle Lowry, but from the outside looking in, the media consensus is that like a lot of the time he can't be bothered. And that doesn't mean he's a bad guy. By all accounts, he's a super nice person. But when interacting with people, he likes to do it on his terms. And he likes to do it his way, which he's afforded the ability to, and that's fine because he's great and he's a basketball savant, like you mentioned. But being that type of person doesn't really lend you a coaching job. You know what I mean? Is like when you're a coach, a lot of the time you're in service, especially in the NBA, of other players. Whereas Kyle Lowry, people are in service to his kind of basketball ideology on the floor. Like he's fantastic. He's selfless. He's a great playmaker. But how he views the game, at least, you know, the stories of how it's voiced in practice or in huddles or during the game, is how Kyle sees the game is pretty much the most important for how the Raptors operate, and obviously to great success. But being an assistant coach or working his way up, like you mentioned, that doesn't seem like it services that ideal for him. And like you said, he probably doesn't have the clout to just walk into a head coaching position. So, you know, I think it would be kind of strange. But also, I'm not like DeMar DeRozan. I'm not, you know, homies. I'm not hanging out with Kyle Lowry all the time. So maybe I'll put the armchair psychology to the side for a second. But it seems like kind of the antithesis of what he's been about, especially with how he handles himself. Is kind of like he's doing his own thing all the time. But with a coach, being a coach, everything has to be focused around other people a lot of the time, I think. And that's, you know, I think that's probably really important. We have a question here from RaptorsRepublic.com, because we did put a post up there from Mr. Tonic. Do you think the Raptors can make up the Kawhi gap by playing stifling defense and getting their points in transition? will there be money to be made taking the underline in Raptors games, at least until Vegas wises up? So I'll take the lead on this one, because you already answered it a little bit earlier on, is that the Raptors fans probably have to get used to the idea that the finals aren't a viable option. And I agree with that sentiment. I don't think the finals are a viable option. I don't even really think the Eastern Conference Finals are a viable option. I think the Raptors are, as currently constructed, a tough out in the second round. And, you know, that's okay for them to be that. We just won a chip for the first time, and that's very exciting, and that's very good. Do I think there's money to be made taking the under line in Raptors games? Not that I'm proficient at betting or anything, but I think that there's going to be a lot. Like, I probably, this is tough. In specific games, from like a game-to-game basis, probably the Raptors get underrated, I guess, quite often by Vegas. You could have made a lot of money last year betting with them. And, you know, especially their season total, I would probably bet the over that they're going to win more games than they were projected to this year. But also, that really depends on what kind of trades go on. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree that their defense is definitely going to be their calling card, especially with the guys they brought in. Like, they're going to have some pretty incredible defensive lineups. Like, if they go big with, you know, OG, Stanley Johnson, Pascal, and like Mark or something like that, with like Fred running the point. Like, I think they have the potential to be a top five defense for sure. So I think on the individual game basis, taking the under is probably a good plan, because there's definitely going to be some nights where they struggle to score and, you know, they win like a mucked up 88 to 82 game or something like that. But I agree that on the season, I think it would be a good idea to take the over, especially if like if they come out the gate strong. Like, I think it's more than likely Masai will find a way to at least keep them together to an extent. And it's kind of the consensus is usually that the Raptors get a little bit underrated in national conversations and stuff like that. So their line is, I'm not quite sure what their line is right now, but I can imagine it's probably a bit lower than people would expect. So
I think I remember seeing it at like 44 or 46, something around there. But I think, you know, provided that the team stays together, I think they should eclipse 46. I would expect, because the team, you know, Kyle Lowry leading it, Pascal Siakam still, you know, surging, Fred VanVleet, Marc Gasol, Serge Ibaka. There's still a lot of talent on the team, and hopefully a good year from OG Anunoby. I think they'll win probably close to 50 games if they stay together. The next question from Miro: how do the Raptors rank in merchandise sales around the world in comparison to other teams? And I'll say this: they were ninth in merchandise sales during the regular season. What happened after they won the championship? I'm not sure. I'm sure that'll be reported later on. But I would assume it's now a lot higher than ninth. What do you think?
Yeah, I think especially where they have such a global footprint on their team, like, you know, with Pascal and Mark and Serge and whatnot, like, I think they can kind of reach a few more markets than other teams. So I wouldn't be surprised if it's a little bit higher, especially based off of, you know, winning the title and whatnot. That's always going to give you a pretty generous bump. But, like, you know, there's always, especially in North America, there obviously is always going to be the Canadian. You're going to be a little bit lower just based off of Americans not wanting to wear the Canadian team's gear and whatnot. But, you know, I still think that this is probably the peak in terms of where they'll be most likely.
Yeah, I think so, too. Like you mentioned, the global footprint is also, like, I hope that if I ever travel to Lagos, like in Nigeria or London, England, I hope I see OG Anunoby everywhere. Like, I want to see those jerseys all the time. Just, I think that would be cool as hell. And yeah, I think that there's a there's a maple leaf on the Raptors jersey, which obviously for Canadians, that's great. And I think it's cool to see that on the jersey. But for Americans, probably a decent amount of them kind of turn their nose up at that. Like, they don't want to wear that. But if you like the Raptors from the jump, that probably wouldn't bother you. But some people buy jerseys because they think it looks cool. So who's to say? Andrew says, what, if anything, can anybody really take from YouTube videos of Rico Hines, Summer League, and or any of the other basketball type stuff over the summer? Is the World Cup at least a little bit predictive, i.e. Gasol can still beast? Is there anything that you put stock in at all? I'll swing this one to you.
Well, last year I did a lot of the summer stuff, like looking at the Rico Hines tape, especially from the perspective of Pascal. And he showed a lot in those runs last summer because he was there just, I think he was there like three times a week. Like they go Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and he missed like two the whole summer. And you could kind of see his progress as the summer went on. Like towards the beginning of the year, he was mainly just like picking and rolling for guys like James Harden, like playing the token Clint Capella role. But on days where there wasn't guys there, he was like leading the break, and his jumper, you could see the progress coming along as it went. And I remember at the end of the year, I was like, I would always say, like, when I make those posts, like, yeah, you can't really take anything from pickup. This is just to like enjoyment from watching. But at the end of the summer, I said, like, as much as I use that qualifier every single time, like, I think Pascal's definitely going to take a step this year. And he ended up doing so, because as much as it's not great basketball, it's still basketball. And when you see stuff that, you know, a spot up jumper is kind of a spot up jumper, really, wherever you are. So there has to be a bit of nuance in what you judge. Like, you know, if you see a guy blowing down the lane when guys aren't really defending very hard, you can't really take much from that. But if you see someone making progress in their handle or in their standstill jump shot, you can take something from that. But yeah, I also agree that the World Cup is definitely the most predictive of all of it. Like, Gasol not being extremely hungover from the championship is a very encouraging sign based off of his World Cup performance. So I think that's a good sign.
And also, Ricky Rubio and the Suns are obviously going to be incredible now. But, well, also, like you said about the Rico Hines thing, I think that it's important to, like, qualify everything when you're watching that. But it's kind of a testament to how tough it is to actually perform in an arena against NBA defense, that as soon as that's kind of taken out of the equation, that these guys just don't miss that often. Like, of course, there's the videos cut to make them look good, but also, like, if you go watch the games at Rico Hines, if you watch any type of pickup for NBA players, like, it's really high level stuff, and they make a lot of shots. They do a lot of cool dribble moves. They make a lot of cool passes. They break out a lot of interesting different things. And honestly, it's, you know, you have to qualify it all, because like you said, there are some things to take away from it. And at the end of the year, the cumulative of it, like a full summer of playing basketball, can be huge and transformative for a guy like Pascal. But if you're just watching like the mixtape of it, it's hard to be like, as an analyst, as a fan, you probably don't want to just take that and say, well, this means this, because the mixtape is, you know, it is what it is, a mixtape. Andrew Wiggins had like the best mixtape of all time in high school, and now he is what he is on the Timberwolves. And, you know, that spin into the lane, 2 foot jump for a dunk that worked in high school, never worked in Kansas, worked about four times in the NBA and once on Rudy Gobert, which is cool, but it's not really predictive for the success in the NBA. But like you said, Pascal Siakam getting to expand his role in those games, getting to try out new things, especially for a guy who learns so quick like he does, because he hasn't been practicing and playing pickup like that his whole life. A lot of NBA players have. They've been doing that type of thing since they're like 8 years old, 7 years old. Siakam, not to beat the dead horse of, oh, he started so late, but he did start later than most, and he's picking up things at a faster rate, a faster clip, and maybe that means that the Rico Hines stuff is a little bit more predictive for him. On the whole, though, I don't put any stock into anything I see. I just, you know, you enjoy the highlights of it. And like you said about Gasol, I think that's just fine and dandy. I think it's really interesting to see him play that way for Spain. And it seemed like Spain's golden era was done, except it wasn't. And I think there's a lot of cool players on Spain. So that was fun to see. Next question from Arshdeep Singh. What's your top 8 seed standing for the Eastern Conference? And I'll let you go first, and I'll tell you if I disagree on any points.
Obviously, Milwaukee 1, Philly 2. And I think if the Raptors keep things together, I've actually kind of got them slotting into third seed. I know that might surprise some people, but I'm not super high on Brooklyn or Indiana or Boston. I think Boston losing Horford is going to have a much bigger effect than people think. And as much as Kemba's a better locker room guy than Kyrie is, he's a very significant talent downgrade. So I'd have Boston 4. Indiana 5, Orlando 7, Orlando 6, Brooklyn 7, and then I'd say Detroit 8.
What about yourself? Yeah, that's pretty good for the top end. I think I go Milwaukee 1, Philly 2, but Philly going to the finals. Raptors 3, Celtics 4, 5 is the Heat for me. Jimmy and their new workout plan with Bam Adebayo. Yeah. And then 6, probably Indiana. 7, I would go Magic. And 8, Nets/Pistons. I'm not high on the Nets, but we'll see. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, reconsidering, I'd probably have the Heat falling in around the 5-6 range. I actually could see them maybe even being better than Indiana. I think people are underrating like the fact that Oladipo probably won't come back as the player that he was. And building an offense around Jeremy Lamb, Malcolm Brogdon, and Miles Turner is going to be tough.
And also, like, Jimmy Butler and Eric Spoelstra and everybody on Miami kind of knowing their role and playing that specific system, I think will be very conducive to regular season success, at the very least, I'd assume. From Robert Parrish 00. Will the league tightening up the travel rule help or hurt the Raptors? Are there any prolific travelers on the Raptors? I know Kyle Lowry does every time he throws an outlet pass, but I don't know if anyone else is like a serial pivot mover or anything like that. Like, Pascal has pretty clean footwork a lot of the time. Can you think of anybody?
Not really, no. I think on the whole, it's going to be good for the league, but I don't think it's going to hurt the Raptors in any real way. So,
yeah, I don't think so either. Well, you obviously you watch a lot of James Harden. What do you think about his 1-foot 3-point shot? Is that a way to navigate the new travel rule? What do you think?
Maybe he got warned about it, and that's probably why he got into it. But I don't know. I think I really hope he gets called for a travel on some type of step back three this year, because sometimes he is really stretching those the gather idea to a bit of an extreme. So, like, do you remember that time last year when Curry did the two step back and then put the 1-3 up? It was like, if I was number 13, you wouldn't call that. And it's like completely true. Like, refs are just kind of afraid to call stuff on Harden, and I hope that this kind of gives them a bit more leeway to do so.
But also, and I guess to play devil's advocate, but also I really like James Harden. I really like what he's been able to do with this game. He is so damn good at it, don't you think? Like, he's taken that rule and manipulated it so well, and not even from like an obnoxious point of view, but like the way he interacts with that rule and the way he stretches it is actually kind of interesting. I don't know if it bothers you, but watching him play and watching him like use the gather step and seeing how far he can stretch it is really interesting to me. And I think there's a reason why Steph Curry would get called, because he's not as practiced at it. Like, mm-hmm. Steph Curry's use of the gather step wasn't as deft as James Harden's, although James Harden's isn't always as deft as it could be. What do you think about his move? Because I really like that move. I think it's an awesome move to watch. And I like watching James Harden interact with that.
I completely agree. I think it's up there with, like, you know, the Kareem skyhook and Dirk one-legged fadeaway in terms of, like, unstoppable signature moves and whatnot. But I think one of the things that's underrated about it is how good he is at drawing fouls based on how he uses the gather, because he does kind of take, like, you know, it's almost like a two-motion type of step back, where the first move he does is almost, like, really quick, and then his second little, like, shuffle of the feet is very slow. So people lunge forward expecting him to take his second step as fast as he took that little first one, and then they end up almost always ending up under him. And he's so good at, like, if you're even within, like, you know, a half a foot radius of him, he can kind of, like, you know, land on you or flail a bit. He's just really mastered, like, in terms of, like, those are the rules of the game, and he knows how to use the rules of the game to his advantage. And, like, and even when he doesn't use them to his advantage, he makes about 40% of them. So it's absolutely unguardable, to be completely honest.
I'm glad you brought that up. Like, one of the most interesting things about that move specifically is the lunge comes, the give and go after that. Like, you pass it, you make the basket cut after your guy lunges at you. I think that's incredibly hard to defend. And, like, he does it every once in a while, right? Like, he'll take the step back, and then if Eric Gordon is just, like, on the 45 extended, he'll swing it to him, and he'll just pass it right back to Harden. Suddenly Harden's going, like, straight downhill for a 2-on-1. It's either a layup dunk or a lob to Capella, something like that. Or he'll spray it to the corner. And like you brought up, is that it's not just a fast move he does. It's he can do anything at any point in time. Like, he has his pickup points at the move.
He has where he can still use the dribble. He has like his pivot in a way, and just he's always watching. Like he's not just picking up, like using the gather dribble, getting into his motion and shooting. Like he's waiting on a number of things to happen before he acts on what he wants to do in that move. Like it's kind of like a triple threat for him, that there's a lot of different ways he could go with it. It's not like just a pickup for a jump shot. And yeah, even though it's like corny, and I know a lot of people dislike James Harden, watching him interact with the rules has been really interesting. And there's a part of me, I know it's like a basketball player thing. I know you hoop a lot. I don't know if you appreciate it, but like guys who hoop, I think there's this appreciation of ISO ball a little bit, because you really understand how hard it is to just ISO up all the time and just get buckets repeatedly. And watching James Harden and Chris Paul do that, just taking turns and stuff like that, has been one of the most enjoyable experiences I've had watching basketball. Even though it's not like the beautiful type of basketball, like Golden State, it's just grind it out, like, all right, D up, I'm going to score on you or I'm not going to do it, is really entertaining for me. But yeah, James Harden, I know he's a maligned figure, but he's fantastic to me. And so for the Raptors podcast, I'll wax poetic about James Harden for the end of it. One more question from Timo in Waterloo. Well, not even a question, really. He just has a picture of himself in front of the stadium, which is cool. And this guy's commented on other things of mine before. He's super nice. Big fan of the Raptors. I guess I'll turn this into a question. Do the Raptors become a more viable tourist option after this? Is that a thing?
You mean the Raptors or Toronto itself?
The Raptors part of Toronto. Because you know when you go to Toronto or Chicago or New York or Los Angeles, there's certain subsects of the city that you go to for different things. Is the arena more of a draw now that they're, you know, the defending champions, or does Kawhi Leonard's exit kind of remove that away from it?
I think it definitely is, especially amongst Canadians. Like, you know, the way that it kind of captured the whole country, where there was Jurassic Parks in just about every single city. Like, I know a lot of my friends like I'm from Newfoundland originally, a lot of them want to come visit sometime, especially like, you know, once they get some type of memorial or some type of monument up to the championship, like whether that's a statue of Kawhi or something like that. Like, I know it's, especially in terms of like the Raptors prior to this year, we're a little bit of like, not like a laughing stock, but like almost like a malign, just based off the way LeBron had treated them the last few years. So I think it's going to do a lot in terms of like making people want to come to the arena and like want to come and like walk outside it. Like, you know, when you go to Chicago and you walk outside the United Center, you almost feel this like aura around it. And I think the Raptors are, you know, at least have a little bit of that now.
And when the Kyle Lowry statue goes up, there'll be a lot of pictures taken with it as well. Something, yeah. And I wonder next year, just because of the Raptors name attached to it, I wonder if the attendance of opposing teams will go up. Like during the Vince Carter years, if you go look at attendance numbers, the Raptors had like a top three away game attendance, like difference percentile when Vince Carter was on the team. Because like if Vince Carter was coming to town, people were getting into the opposing gym to watch him. Even though it wasn't the Raptors team, it was just you wanted to go see Vince Carter. Do you think there's going to be any aspect of that in the fandom that they want to go see the defending champions? Do you think that'll rise this year at all?
I don't really think it will, because I think a lot of the draw would have been to see Kawhi. And yeah, now that he's gone, I think a lot of people are just going to be like, okay, this is a second round fodder team. So I don't think there'll be as much of people like trying their best to go see it.
I think there's going to be 8 people the duration of the year that saw Kyle Lowry and just were smitten with his game and like, wow, everybody had it wrong the whole time. Kyle Lowry is fantastic. I love playoff Kyle Lowry. And there's going to be 8 people, and we're all going to love them for it. But it's not going to be a sizable amount at all. The last question from Jules McCool's management. Great name. If we traded away Lowry, Gasol, and Ibaka separately or together, God, could you imagine that trade, all 3 of them? What kind of return could we get? Also, how did you come up with your have a blessed day sign off? Well, I'll let you get into the type of return. What do you think?
Well, I think a lot of it's going to be dependent on how they look to start the year, because as much as their playoff run like definitely boosted their value. I think, you know, if they come out and they look, you know, they're 10 pounds overweight and they're not really like looking very sharp, their value is obviously going to drop a lot. Like if they have a Dallas Mavericks 2012 type of year. But I don't really have the trade machine up right now, so I can't say for certain what they could get. But I think Gasol and Lowry especially could pull a lot of value. Like, you know, both of those guys can show they're still very high level starters in this league. Ibaka, I feel like, would maybe at best net like a couple seconds, similar to maybe Mirotić last year, just to be like a depth piece for someone trying to like really swing for the fences. But I think Lowry and Gasol could definitely have like very good returns.
Yeah. How much do you want to bet Masai is on the phone with somebody right now saying like Marc Gasol, he almost won MVP, he was the most important player for Europe, give me Jaylen Brown. Like there's something like that going on right now, like he's trying to swing something. I think Marc Gasol, as far as trades go, it would be really interesting to see if he was being asked from like Western Conference teams who are projecting maybe Jokic playoff matchups. Like if he's being, you know, mired in those types of situations, I think that's a possibility. Also, like you said, how they play matters, obviously. But obviously, if you win a championship, there's a little gold star that gets put next to your name, and you become one of those people who teams always want to have on their squad for the playoffs because you have the playoff experience, you have championship experience, you can talk the locker room through things. So Ibaka, Lowry, and Gasol all having that, obviously is super important. Lowry, I think, would be really tough to trade because he's so good still that I don't think they'd be able to get a good enough package for him. And maybe that's a bit of homerism playing into how I view that, but I think that what he does on the floor is super hard to replace, and so much of it is underrated in the trade market that I just don't know if you could get what you wanted back. Like, there are things like you could get like Jeff Teague or something and maybe a pick, but is that enough? Does that make you happy at the end of the day? This is the point guard who took you to a championship. He's in the war of the Raptors forever. Like, what does that become for the fans, Masai Ujiri, everybody at large? But Gasol, I think, probably is the most likely to go, I would think. And he could have a really good playoffs on the team, especially as a Jokic or Embiid defender. I think it'd be really interesting to see that. And Ibaka, I mean, Ibaka was great in the playoffs last year, so you get any number of things back for him. But I would guess that it would be picks and cap relief or something like that. Like something to open up the books for when they try and pair Pascal Siakam and Giannis Antetokounmpo together. Something of that ilk. And for me, how did I come up with my Have a Blessed Day sign off? I don't view Have a Blessed Day as like specifically religious or spiritual. I think it can apply to any spirituality, which I think is nice. And I think it's a nice sentiment to give to people. I think, you know, it's personal, it's heartfelt, and I generally mean it. Whenever I finish a piece, I feel pretty good, and I glow in my optimism, and I feel warm because, you know, I just accomplished something. And I really, there's a reason I respond to the comments, and there's a reason I do mailbags and stuff like that, is I really appreciate the readership, listenership, viewership of all the stuff that I do. I think it's a really cool thing to be a part of. I grew up reading Raptors Republic, so I'm very appreciative of the people who write on this site. I'm very appreciative of the people who read this site and who interact on this site. And it's, you know, it makes me feel good. And so that makes me wish blessings upon everybody who graces any one of my posts or podcasts. So that's where it comes from. It's not specifically a religious thing or anything like that. Do you have any sign-offs you use?
Not really. I guess I haven't really had a consistent platform enough to really give one, but I'd like to develop one at some point for sure.
Do you have anything in the works?
Not
Does
as
anything
yet.
Come to mind?
No, I'll workshop some maybe next time I'm on, but we'll see.
Oh, then you could have the sign off. Could be pretty good. Well, I feel like that's a great place to leave it. A mailbag episode, yeah. almost an hour. I think we talked about a lot of interesting stuff, cascading over different topics, but I think we did a good job. I feel good about how we answered most of the things. How are you feeling?
Great, yeah. I was really pleased with the questions the listeners had. Like, you know, that's Raptors Republic. We have very intelligent listeners and readers.
There you go. Is there anything that you have coming up or anything you want to plug or talk about before we get out of here?
No, nothing as of yet. Like, I'm sure I'll have some good preseason pieces eventually, but that's still a few weeks off. So looking forward to the season.
All right. For you, listener, if you liked Colin's takes, his point of view, his perspective, you can get more of that at ColinConnors4, and that's on Twitter. And obviously, if you read Raptors Public, you'll see him posting frequently or infrequently whenever he gets it up. And for me, I'm Sam Folk. You don't need to follow me on Twitter. It seems a cesspool to me, so just ignore it. And thank you so much for listening. Colin, thank you so much for coming on again, man.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. And to everybody, have a blessed day and goodbye.
Hello, I'm Jack Wilson. I'm here to tell you about my podcast, The History of Literature.
Hello. This is Edgar Allan Poe.
Hello. Oh, hello. I'm Elizabeth Bennet.
Hello.
Of
come on
hello.
In.
I'm Emily Dickinson.
Come on in.
Hello.
Of room.
This is Bartleby.
Hello, it's me, Lady Macbeth.
The Scrivener.
Whoa. On The History of Literature, we journey through the world of great books, taking a look at everything from the Epic of Gilgamesh to contemporary classics. We talk to authors and professors, and once in a while, we have a special guest.
Hello, I'm Oliver Twist.
The History of Literature podcast with Jack Wilson, where literature comes to life. Join us.
We'll consider ourselves grateful.
Thank you, Oliver.
More gruel, please, sir.
You bet.
Just in time for the holidays, fill your home and your season for less at HomeDepot.com. With up to 40% off a wide assortment of select bedding and bath linens. Update your bed or bath online, right from the comfort of your own cozy couch. Even get free delivery and flexible returns. How's that for holiday cheer? Up to 40% off. Holiday home decor improved from HomeDepot.com. How doers get more done. Online only. Free delivery on select items $45 or more. Visit HomeDepot.com for more information.
Want to hear something amazing? Discover matches all the cash back you earn on your credit card at the end of your first year, automatically, dollar for dollar, with no limit on how much you can earn. Extra cash? Come on, how amazing is that? In fact, it's even more amazing when you realize all the places where Discover is accepted. 99% of places in the U.S. that take credit cards. So when it comes to Discover, get used to hearing yes more often. Learn more at discover.com/yes. 2020 Nielsen Report. Limitations apply.